We'd like to welcome everybody here to Bebop Radio North. Yeah. Back. The Bebop for the
opportunity of the public school board meeting. We have one attendant here right now, and we just go in and have a guy that we're going to have a class with. This is your junior year.
And they were here.
In the primary, we get 2010, we have a candidate.
And we're live on the first hour. First hour. We have 220 listeners around the country right now. And our call number is 877-572-288 in about an hour. Hope we'll take the call. Okay.
First of all, I appreciate
it. Thank you. Dick, I'm glad to see you made it. We have two out of four. It looks like it's going okay. One of the genesis, if you will, for our was the unfortunate story with the athlete. So, but it's in fact, he stands on the earth for the first time, first year, at the whole African-American State. And the reality is that would be extremely egregious if you don't talk about history, just consider ourselves and did both our sponsors, our radio, they may be facilitate 2 hours for the time block for this forum. Again, to the two candidates that are here, welcome, and we appreciate you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much again for being here, and I just want to let everybody know that personally, Mr. Baker, and go ahead and take 5 minutes, and I'll platform need that much. Can we go ahead, Mr. Madden? Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Good evening to everyone and all the listeners on the radio. I'm Shauna Smith Baker. I'm an at-large candidate for the Minneapolis School Board. I'm a Northside resident. Have lived in the Northside for all of my life and fourth generation. My educational background really started when my oldest son, who's now a senior in high school, was born, and I couldn't leave him at home, and I started doing early childhood daycare and really got into kind of the preschool, the early childhood dynamic. I did that for about 7 years, and then I moved on to St. David's. I did some work in special education. And then went to Hennepin County and did some research in terms of why weren't communities of color accessing resources that were available for the community for respite services and other services in special education. In 2000, I came to work for Pillsbury United Communities, which has neighborhood centers and community organization locations in the core neighborhoods. And educational issues kept coming up with the families and in our leadership discussions. And so I increasingly had more and more interest in working in education. I did go to St. Cloud State. There was a teacher of color program there, that program. And I've led Pillsbury's relationships with the district over years, and I volunteered in many of the schools. And so I have to say that, you know, now I have 5 children. I have 2 in high school, 2 in elementary, 1 in middle. The decisions, the impact of education, certainly in my household and in many, many households, has been a topic of much discussion in terms of how are we going to make sure that all kids are moving forward. And then certainly how are we going to address the needs of kids that are falling the furthest behind? And so, you know, I guess a great deal of my educational journey has been one that has included research. And that research has not only included online and reading, but it's included traveling across the country. I've visited over 35 of the top performing schools in the country, both district and charter, and other things to just learn what's innovative and how are other cities getting the proficiency rates that they were. So I was looking at 90-90-90 schools, 90% low income, 90% kids of color, and then 90% proficiency rates. And so that somewhat fed into the launch of the Hope Collaborative. That was a joint effort, but certainly saying how can we bring some of that hope and some of that option to Minneapolis? What does it take? Is the way that they engage parents different? Is that different? Is the environment, how do they build the culture? How do they get the students to perform into college like they did? So I think that my range of experience, both personally, academically, and then in my work experience has brought me to this point. So thank you for inviting me tonight. I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you very much. Matt.
And also thank you, Mr. Edwards, Mr. Allen, for this opportunity. It's good to be with Shonda again. This has been a long trail we've been on together for many, many months, and I have become very hopeful through this adventure that there is capacity in this community to turn our schools around and to make this a valued institution again. I come to this as a lifelong resident of Minneapolis. I'm 60 years old, grew up here. It's kind of fun to be in this actual setting because I can look across the street and see where my father's bowling alley was, where I spent a number of my formative days. But I am a product of the Minneapolis Public Schools. My parents were products of the Minneapolis Public Schools. My mother graduated from North. My father graduated from Central. I graduated from Washburn. I have three children, two who have graduated from Minneapolis Public Schools, one who just started ninth grade on Monday. I believe in the public schools. I think it's one of the things that pulls this community together, and I've discovered more and more in the last years it's one of the things that pulls it apart. I think that our schools are at a crossroads. When I realized that a number of the incumbents wouldn't be coming back, I was concerned about the stability of the schools. I was concerned about the ability for new ideas to come forward and for people to be empowered to take back the schools and to set this, that'd be the institution that really pulls us together, because I believe in children. For the past 40 years, I've been professionally involved in the lives of young people, starting as an outreach worker in this very neighborhood for the YMCA, working with delinquent kids, court-referred kids, kids who are on the edge. I taught at North High in the School of Survival in that program, in the Unity School on 26th and Fremont. I worked with kids in the juvenile justice system, went from that to develop the first day treatment program, a contract alternative school called Katahdin, a workshop for youth. Moved from that to develop economic development programs for at-risk youth, if you will. And then had 7 years of working in public policy as the first director of the Youth Coordinating Board. And working with Mayor Fraser at the bequest of Shonda's uncle, Richard Green, who asked that the mayor and the other governments work together to provide the supports the children needed, that the schools could teach reading and math and those things, but that they had to come to school ready. And so I worked very long and hard in that environment to try to achieve that. Left that, and I always say I left City Hall while I was still angry and not cynical, because there's hope in anger. And I believe that we could do a better job. For the past 5 years, that I did consulting and a number of things, including with the school district, working on youth development issues and how we might bring resources together. My issues really stem from empowering this community, the parents, the students themselves, and involving them in the decisions that affect them. certainly the collaborative agreement. We've got to pull together schools as enterprises, can't be isolated, and we need to be accountable. All of us need to be accountable for the results that come. So I came to this thinking that I had something to offer in terms of bringing people together. I've gotten an extensive set of relationships with people that know that I'm committed to children, all children. And I believe that we can do a better job if we are all accountable for that. So I look forward to tonight's discussion. I look forward to the discussions of the next 2 months and the next 10 years about what we can do in this community to make things better for kids and all families.
Thank you. For purposes of clarity, if you will, I'm fine.
And so you see, the standard rules is not part of the personal teaching
decision. We do have an announcement. Mr. Allen and myself informed that one of the candidates is pledging to get involved.
Yeah, Rebecca Gagnon is stuck on the map. This is being broadcast by CrossWest International. It's our international listeners. You can call in at our show at 1-877-572-4288. Ask questions. That's called a couple other places. Questions. Canada. Also, on Saturday at 10 a.m. to 12 noon at Sunnyside Restaurant, we're going to be having a roundtable about education. Buffet at 1095. Good move there. Have an open conversation. Let you know. And moving right ahead, sir. Offer 24 at Black Court. Enormous amount of violence. None of them will take other things to take place without publicity of the brother. Just want to kind of. And then kind of go first life. No child left. The federal legislation. That folks could keep in school and we need Minnesota is slowly going down the hill. The achievement gap between white and black male students compared to white imagine at 31%. And in Minnesota between white and black male students at 39%. And so we have things happening that we have to address. The start came out of the numbers. You know, the schools in North Seattle barely have or did not have any of the meeting for the genesis of this form is thought for Canada and
their position and how we direct them all this and make something happen.
Bring it back
is when Richard Green was superintendent of the school
and I'm off the school. Where were they admired across on that? We're back. And we have this chance to take a seat here. And before we move forward, go ahead and listen to your introduction. Go ahead, please. So, 5 minutes.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Gagnon, and I am an at-large candidate. I live in Southwest Minneapolis. My children attend 3 Minneapolis public schools, Southwest High School, Whittier International, and Lake Erie Upper Campus. I have been deeply involved in the past 2 years in the district on the District Parent Advisory Council, the Special Ed Advisory Council, the Title I Advisory Council representing Whittier, and I am also the co-chair of the Steering Committee for Area C, which is the breakdown of the groups that form DPAC, the District Parent Advisory Council. I began to think about running for school board because I, just being involved, I noticed that we definitely have the resources and the talent to make this district function in all areas, north, south, east, and west. But we don't necessarily use those resources appropriately, and we don't always finish what we start, and we don't always implement with integrity. So based on those 3 things, I knew that I could be an asset to the district and bring my talents and my time to the board and work collaboratively with the communities, the board, the district, the schools, the teachers, to implement change and proceed towards the strategic goals, which are very reasonable and goals that would benefit the district. We just haven't quite figured out how to reach them yet.
Thank you, Bruce. And Seth, before we move into the question phase, I'd like to give a few words.
No, what I would do is indicate there is a format change because we have raised three of the four candidates. We will
add an additional 1 minute.
The first question. Start the debate over your right. How would you evaluate the academic officer for the district? What is the
area?
Well, I would evaluate the academic officer as part of my role on the school board and as a collective effort with the other board members. The superintendent has a contract, and the current board has made put some conditions in that that's contingent on her meeting for a bonus that's in place, and so certainly that is looking at any progress towards the goals that are written out in the strategic plan. I do think, let's see, my experience in this area. At Pillsbury United Communities, I have had experience working with charter schools as part of my role, and I think that that is a benefit that I bring to the board, certainly because of the new schools office and the rollout of some new schools. But, in fact, I think that some of it is good because of this right here, and that we do have to look at the goals that are written out in their contract and all the state statutes and to make sure that they're making progress and growth for the students that they're working with. And so I do have experience directly working in this particular area. I do think that the progress and the reports that come out, the quarterly reports towards the strategic plan is going to be really important, and I think that the board is going to have to respond to the data that's being presented and be prepared to make some shifts in strategy and approach if the numbers aren't reading and the progress is not being shown.
I really have to agree with Ms. Baker on all fronts. This is really tied to the metrics that are involved in the strategic plan and our role in supervising the contract of the superintendent. This is about leadership, and the academic officer for the district is charged with a great deal of leadership for what happens, particularly with principals in all the schools. So applying the values and the principles and the strategies of the plan and then measuring back to that is the best way to evaluate that person and the functioning of the whole system. With to the previous experience in this area, I've served on over 20 nonprofit, corporate boards, a number of things that have had the similar experience of evaluating executives and key leaders in an organization. I believe that I know most of the, nuances of leadership. I know how we can measure success and see success from a financial standpoint to actually a operational implementation standpoint. And so I think that experience provides that. I've certainly been around the district to see that happen as well. But it is the willingness to tell truth and to expect honest, accountable answers. And I think that that is something that I will certainly bring to this board and ask probably more difficult questions than has been the pattern in the past.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. The board is actually only tasked to evaluate the superintendent. The superintendent then is working on the accountability system for the leadership below her. Now, of course, the academic officer is at that top tier of leadership, and certainly as a school board member, one of the ways that I would evaluate would be what information she provides based on the questions and the needs of the board, because sometimes it seems that we don't always get all the information. So we need to have appropriate and full information to make the decisions we need to make. Also, in evaluating the superintendent, which she would rely heavily upon the outcomes of the academic officer, which deal greatly with achievement, the bonus structure of Bernadette Johnson has just been shifted to, instead of evenly distributed between the three goals, achievement now has 50% weight, while board goals have 40% weight, and community engagement has 10% weight. So achievement obviously is extremely important to the board, to the district, to the employees, and therefore I am assuming that Bernadette would be working closely and leaning upon the academic officer to help her achieve those goals. Right now there is no academic officer, so they are in the hiring process, and we are looking forward to seeing what type of person comes into that role, if they bring outside knowledge and so forth. And, well, thank you. I'm done.
Thank you. Just have Mr. Williams to come in. And we had just started on the first question here, and if you'd like to go ahead and 3 minutes, you can have yourself in a minute. The question was, how will you judge as an academic officer for the district? What has been your previous experience?
Thank you, and I apologize for being late. I had this down for 6:30 instead of 5:30, so I live about a minute and a half away from here. How will you evaluate the academic officer of the district? Well, we are currently we are finalizing an evaluation plan for the superintendent, and the superintendent has the responsibility of evaluating all of her direct reports. The academic officer is a direct report, and the academic officer's goals should be compatible with those of the superintendent. The district has met with the superintendent and helped her put together her performance goals, which we will use to measure her performance over the next year, and it's tied to her contract. It is the expectation that the superintendent will require the same kinds of goals, performance goals, from her direct reports as we are requiring of her. And her performance is really going to be tied to how well her direct reports perform. Well, the experience that I've had in doing that is that I chaired the evaluation committee for Superintendent Bill Green, where we worked with him to establish his performance goals and reviewed those over the life of his contract. So I have had experience in working with that, and I we will be looking closely at the performance of the superintendent.
Thank you very much. We're going to switch back now. So move on with the question.
I think it's fairness. Please, would like to 3 minutes.
Well, thank you, and I apologize again. I'm T. Williams. I'm running for re-election to the board. I'm the only incumbent who is running for re-election. I brought to me with the board considerable experience from the community, and I have focused on educational reform issues in my prior to coming to the board.
And what I am, one of the reasons why I am very strongly interested in running for re-election is to help us implement some strategies that have already been initiated. And our focus is going to be on increasing equity, expectations, and achievement. We want to raise the expectations and academic rigor for all students, aligning the pre-K program with the college readiness goals. We'll identify correct practices and policies that perpetuate the achievement gap and institutional racism in all forms. We want to develop highly effective principal core and ensure that they have capacity to establish and lead outstanding instructional teams. That is already in the process of being implemented, that we are evaluating our principles. We want to strengthen our relationships, transform relationships and partners with the families, build widespread internal and external support and partnerships to get results. We want to restructure the lowest performing 25% of our schools, increasing the flexibility and autonomy for the lowest and highest performers, create and sustain a positive financial
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Before we move on here, we have to pay some bills. You're listening to On Point with Ron Edwards and Don Allen on Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com, IBNN News. And moving on, we're here today for the 2010 Minneapolis Public School Board Candidate Forum held live in North Minneapolis. We're going to move on to question number two. Thank you. Question number two. Professor now, what is the financial status of the district? What is the district's bond rating? And where is the most support have you seen? And we'll start with that. And we have 2 minutes to go back.
Well, quite honestly, let me start with the second one. The most recent report, and have you seen it? No, I haven't seen it. I haven't read it. I'm responding more to what I read in the paper and what I hear from people. And it is currently the financial status continues to change every week, whether it's the new Obama money coming for more teachers and what that $8 million is going to mean. I do know from different versions of what happens with the teacher's contract and the janitor's contract and all the other contracts, that things move between $4 million shortfall and a $14 to $18 million shortfall. So the honest answer is, I don't know.
All right. Well, the recent financial report that I've seen in the past month or so is from the district, and this year they ended up with they'll end up with a balanced budget, but next year they will have a shortfall. It went from $11 million to $19 million, now to $20 million, and that doesn't necessarily take into consideration the funds withheld by the state. Of course, there are now new funds through the Obama, not only the teachers' plan, but the educational reform that are coming in, but we have yet to see what Pawlenty will ask for from that. The financial status, currently, the most often word used that I heard from the district is unsustainable. So the cuts and the way we've balanced the budget now is based on factors that are not sustainable. They will not continue. So therefore, we have to find another way in the future to make cuts. That is just the reality, or we have to use our reserves, which are almost at $90 million, which you can't obviously do for a long period of time. The district's bond rating, I am uncertain as to that, but I do know that the new board will have quite a bit to deal with the financial situation of the district.
Who have had a very lovely done that fallen to me. Now, because the big round like from the sideline football. So, now, what the panel is supposed to do. So 1 minute, 30 seconds. If you go a little bit far beyond.
Thank you. Mr.
Currently, we are facing a $19 million deficit for next year. The budget is currently in balance, and we balance that budget by a combination of drawing down on the reserve, and we requested every administrative division to take cuts. The academic affairs cuts there 6%, policy and operation 7%, and we are continuing to review those cuts. None of this is really permanent because we don't know what our relationship is going to be with the state, what kind of shortfalls will continue to be there. But we are anticipating to have to find ways to cut next year $19 million from the budget. The state deficit is almost $1 billion dollars for 2010-11, and almost $6 billion for 11 and 12. The state has borrowed money from the district, from our reserves. I have to correct what Ms. Gannon said. The reserve is not at almost $90 million. It's more like between 60 and $65
million.
Thank you.
That's okay. You know, the district budget is fragile, and I think there's a lot of factors that are in it. And I think one of the biggest considerations are the unfunded mandates that are coming down federally that's creating quite a problem with the day-to-day operational budget. The state is expecting, or the governor is talking about a 30% holdback for next year, which I think is going to be pretty considerable, more than this year. It's going to eat away at the fund balance, and I think that next year is going to be, frankly, more difficult than this year. I see Director Stewart in the audience, and I was at a board meeting not that long ago where they talked about right-sizing the district and doing that and having some pretty courageous conversations about what's currently within the district's portfolio of programs, where the spending is happening, and have a plan to look at things not just from a short-term reactive stance but from a long-term and short-term strategy, such as having retention targets for the current students that are in the district, having enrollment targets, and doing some things so that it doesn't become just about cuts, but it becomes around stabilizing the student population that we have, trying to grow that population, and then looking at some ways to be more creative in terms of partnering, because there are some things that are happening right now in the district that can certainly some of the nonprofit organizations or others could take some of that financial burden off the district so that we can concentrate on the core work of academic outcomes.
Thank you. This is what it's called, the home portion. Director Williams, they mentioned financial arrangements allowed by the Constitution of the State of Minnesota. Has the money that was borrowed from the State of Minnesota from the district, has that money been paid? If so, if not, what does it mean?
Give me 1 minute to answer.
No, it has not, and we don't anticipate that it will be repaid, not as the state faces a $6 billion deficit. That money was taken from our reserves, and the state delayed its deferred its payment to the district with the anticipation of in the future catching up on that. But I don't think we can plan as a district
that money will be repaid to us. We have to see that really in a sense as a permanent reduction in the budget and find other means for recouping those resources.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Gagnon, please.
Well, T already answered the question, has it been repaid? I would have to agree. I know that in the past this has happened before, and it took the state somewhere in the range of 11 years to pay the money back. When you listen very closely to the governor's race, at first you heard, we support education, we're going to do the right thing by education, and now with the billion-dollar budget deficit, you're hearing, well, we probably won't be able to pay them back, but we're going to do right by education. So it should be a very interesting conversation coming up in the next few months with a thing to really approach the governor candidates about.
Yeah, I was aware of the previous payments and how it has taken 10 to 11 years to repay. This has been a boondoggle for years, the way the funding strategies is for the district, that we don't even know where things are, and it changes all the time in flux. We've got to solidify some of these arrangements with the state, and that requires other leadership in the governor's race and the legislature, the Department of Education. And at some point, we need an outbreak of common sense, folks. I mean, this thing is just kind of crazy. And, to be accountable for that kind of craziness is, I think, one of the problems that we have for elected officials and others.
I think this question, and I agree with the answers. I'm not sure, though, how long the payment from the past holdback took. I know that it was a considerable amount of time, but, I mean, it goes to my point around the budget being fragile and being very difficult to forecast and make decisions because from year to year or as the political environment changes in the city, I think it's going to be very difficult to make some of those changes. So I think having contingency budgets and having kind of the what-if scenarios is extremely important. I have heard rumors that they're going to do a 10% repayment, and the conversation and the percentages have been changing, so I don't think that the state has gotten to a place of knowing.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move to question three, but before we do that, on July 29, 2010, the story came out in the Star Tribune, 19 struggling schools in Grant. Question three. How the grant awards could be spent? Give us your understanding of how the grant is being spent. And we start with again, way back.
All right. So thank you. The grant awarded to Bethune, these grants have to be spent in accordance to the rules under the No Child Left Behind transformation. And those are very specific rules and a little bit stifling for the schools, but they have to work on teacher development, professional development for the teachers, and they're going to be used to really evaluate the processes that have been going on and what's working and what is not working and what they can do to raise those up and fix any of those processes. So a major evaluation of the structure of the school, the implementation of curriculum, and putting resources to most benefit the child in the classroom.
The honest answer is I don't know. I haven't seen a budget for any of the AYP schools, whether that's Edison or Bethune, and whether that takes away from existing resources. You know, Rebecca is correct. There are requirements that come with this. But if there's been a shifting of other resources that existed before away to accommodate these, I don't know. I haven't seen those plans for those schools, is the honest answer.
Yeah, the grant process was a SIG grant process that came down from the federal government. Basically, the state got $35 million to do the turnaround process, and the process that the schools had to apply was very short in terms of turnaround, and it did include some of the things that Ms. Gagnon spoke of. I think in terms of the exacts and how it's being spent, it's just the school year has just started, so as they go through, they are getting monitored along the way in terms of performance and outcome. I think the problem with the process, and this has been talked about on a national level, is the fact that it's imposed on and that there's not input from community parents and students in terms of the goals and outcomes.
The funds are in the process of being spent. They've been allocated. We had a quality school review conducted by the Cambridge Education Group that of all of our schools, every school, and in that quality review, it identified key things that needed to be done. And so that in each school is putting together a quality plan to reform the school. And those resources are applied to that. And it has to focus on student learning and ways to improve performance of the students. They also, funds are available to use where we're required to use outside consultants to assist students who are failing to make progress. And we are... progress. And one of the board is raising questions about our lack of any real control over who is engaged to work with the failing schools, because we know very little about their performance.
Thank you. Before we get to question four, some of you weren't here yet, but I want to back up here because this was in a Saturday review. It showed of Minneapolis, actually, Minneapolis Public Schools. Look at the list of Minneapolis Public Schools. And if you see it in here,
we don't have listings for several of the schools here as far as the scores.
Including
Minneapolis
Urban League School and City 8. I don't know if they took the test or didn't take the test or whatever, but when you talk about quality of schools, we're going to jump back here to question four. What would you do? What could you do differently to test for Minneapolis Public School System? And we'll start up.
I think the biggest strategy to increase test scores is to increase confidence in the schools themselves and the relationship between the teachers, the parents, the students, the administration in that building. And with that, then quality curriculum that is evidence-based, effective curriculum, it requires a lot of staff development, but it also requires a lot of parental involvement and being involved in actually supporting the efforts in the classroom. So what I would do differently is try to involve as many people as possible in the goals of improving achievement. And that is also not just math and English, but actually having a sense of hope and a purpose for being there.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Increasing test scores requires that we look really from the bottom up, and I think the district has started to do this. What increases learning, a core knowledge, and building on that every year, and how does that work? Well, reducing class size, which we still desperately need to work on across the district, and differentiation in the classroom allows for children to be taught at their level and to progress academically with rigor and high goals, what they're able to progress a year's worth of growth in a year. Also, we need to... you know, we have high schooler now that obviously can't start back at kindergarten. And we have a lot of money for tutoring. We have a lot of money for educational support that we don't always utilize. We need to have greater access to our kids, go to the communities, give them this opportunity. Don't wait for them to come and ask us for it.
Thank you.
We would start with qualified classroom teachers who can teach children with different learning styles.
Engage parents or caring adults. Wrap around social health services, social and health services readily accessible to the students. Community institutions actively engaged as partners with the schools in support of student learning. a system that holds all participants in the educational process accountable for measurable outcomes. And we have begun to implement an accountability system with our principals because we know that there needs to be strong instructional leadership coming from the principals. And we will be asking the principals to review the performance of the teachers. Teachers have pushed back on that because they felt that we were not holding the principals accountable. Now we are beginning to hold the principals accountable, so the expectation is that the principals will begin to work more closely with the students, with the teachers, to improve their performance.
One of the things I believe is that the district needs to really adopt a language of whatever it takes, that while we're trying to increase test scores and academic results, I'm not convinced that we believe that academic success for all kids is possible. So I think that if we don't have the right attitude and the right framing of it, it's very difficult to move kids where you don't think that they can go. The kids, also, I think that in some ways and across the state, we've taken this cookie-cutter approach to what it takes to get the kids to proficiency in testing. And what we do know is everyone does not learn the same way. We need to adopt multiple strategies of teaching so that we can reach kids at their learning style, which I think is extremely important. One of the key things that I'm in support of are multiple measurements, and that we look at students, but we also may need a different strategy for different groups that we're trying to move forward. So as an example, for graduation rates, if we're trying to improve African-American boys, we have a target and we have a plan that matches with that, so we can adjust where we need to. And then I think, again, we need to have some strategies, and I don't know if putting that amount of pressure on the whole system around the test scores is obviously not working. That is one thing you want to be able to improve, but now someone, you know, you're so focused on that we need to move back and remember that teaching and learning is actually supposed to be enjoyable.
Thank you.
Ma'am, please. Excuse me. I thought I answered this first.
Oh, we've been all the way around.
For the second time.
Well, let's move on.
Can I give you a little free form here? The individual, you know, and treating kids as the subjectification of our school system and recognizing people as people with families from communities is something that we've missed with all this objectification of tests. And I think if we teach and treat people as individuals, we will find solutions. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, let us hear the fairness to the other candidates. All right.
Oh.
I think that we place so much emphasis on performance on standardized tests that we really miss the boat. The challenge with us is that the mobility in our schools is so high that students taking the test are not in class, in the same class for the whole year.
Thank you. Ms. Smith, Ms. Baker, do you have anything to interject?
No, I made my point.
Yeah,
so, before we move on to question five, we just let everybody know this is being broadcast live on Blog Talk Radio, and probably in the next 20 minutes, you're about midway towards the end of the show, we're going to have comments and questions from the audience. We have some of the questions, not right now, but when we get to that point. No, not right now. We're still going to question and answer that. So we'll go to question number five, which is, how would you defend against receivership in order for you to start willing to go that way? Okay? You have minutes.
Yeah, well, because I have not seen any research that shows that receivership has worked significantly better than what the districts have been able to do themselves. I don't know of any experience that we've had in Minnesota with receivership. I don't think that our schools are at such a point that we warrant going into receivership. Receivership is reserved for those situations where things have gone
significantly beyond the control and the capacity of the leadership to handle it. That would require, if we were moving to receivership, I think that it would require, should require, the resignation of all board members and the superintendent and move forward from there. I don't believe we have that, and so we aren't at that point. I think that our academic performance, if you, what would one receivership that we have several schools that are performing outstandingly, and that if we're going to put the whole district into receivership, you know, what would be the basis of that? It's a question that I really haven't paid much attention to, because I don't think we're anywhere near, and it would be it's something that I would resist with all of my heart and soul. If we aren't there, I don't think we're going to get there in the short term.
Thank you. Ms. Baker, you have 2 minutes.
Yeah, I would echo Mr. Williams. I haven't thought a lot about this. This is an interesting question, because on one hand, you could see with the schools that are grossly underperforming, you know, we do have to do something different. On the other hand, the way that I understand receivership also is that there's a number of things that are happening, and that it's out of control. And most of the time, the situation that I've seen it is when boards are split and decisions are not being made and progress is not being made across the board. So I think that certainly if I get on the board, I would hate to see that, and I would want to have an opportunity to make a difference. So I would obviously fight against it.
Thank you.
Is that right?
Yes.
Mr.
Mayor, please.
This is such a doomsday question that I've got to echo what Mr. Williams and Ms. Baker said. I think that the system isn't necessarily half full or half empty. It might be two sizes too big, but, you know, we're not at a point that we need to move to that. And I think Spaker's absolutely right. Where this has happened in the past, it's been mainly a fractious board and a lack of leadership and a resolve and a consistent pressure to achieve results. Kansas City went through a very similar experience, closed many, many, many schools, damaged that system, and I think that educational environment in that community and just the identity of the community terribly, and they're struggling to get back. But we can provide that leadership. I think we can find an agreement. There are schools that are doing well. The ones that aren't doing well are disproportionately in communities that are economically challenged. We've got to confront that challenge, and we can't just do it with the schools. We've got to do it with metro-wide solutions in terms of addressing the economic racism that exists in this metro region.
Thank you.
This is certainly the opposite of the attitude that we want our entire community and district administration, parents, families to have. We can achieve. We have the resources. We have the talent. We have the leadership. The four people sitting here that want to run, I mean, we are very capable and passionate about this. And there is, just to go down the path that you think we are going to absolutely fail to this extent, is almost, hopefully, you know, you would not be setting it up to do so. And I would not be running for the board if I thought we were anywhere in that position. We have the number one public high school in the state. We have schools and children that are national merit scholars that are achieving, and I cannot imagine with the wonderful teaching staff, the leaders, the resources, the schools that we currently have, why we would have this conversation.
Thank you very much. Question. Six, I just want to just let you know they're planning to spend or build the headquarters of the app. I've been to the meetings that they have.
as community meetings. But when you get there to the meeting, everyone that they want there has a pre-printed name tag from the district. So these are community meetings, you know, why you just don't make the tag or keep people in the public, it's really just making sense. So, Chris and I and a couple other folks that are in the room, we just kind of went up there to hear what's going on. I had a militia and things like that in October. And I took an interview with a young man who had a house right behind the school there, coming to him himself. We're not offering him peanuts. But I say that to set up question number six. What does the Minneapolis public provide? Does the Minneapolis school district need another headquarters? What would be the benefit to the community? Again, this car comes work our way back. You have no benefits.
The Minneapolis administration moved into the 807 decades ago as a very temporary status. Obviously, it has not been temporary, that building. It's not really fit for people to be working in it. It needs a lot of work. It needs a lot of health issues addressed, roof issues, aircon issues, heat issues. That said, so do a lot of our schools. And does the district need a new headquarters? Absolutely, they do. Do many of our schools need air conditioning? Do they need the asbestos removed from the building? Do they need, you know, a variety of very basic things? Yes, they do. So the decision to do one versus the other, I don't know, quite goes by the strategic plan to keep the money in the classroom, benefiting the children, because the children that are in buildings that are falling apart around them are health hazards. It's not conducive to learning.
Thank you.
I haven't been convinced that the district needs another headquarters. I think that the assumptions that the administration, the way it's configured now, and the functioning of our administration and the backroom function are possibly erroneous. I think there's some things that we can do to change that, and that's through collaborative experience. So the assumption that we need space for 500 or 600 or 700 employees is one that I was not willing to accept. And I will trust the board and not second-guess them in making that decision. The building that they are in, as Ms. Gagnon points out, is a horrendous building and has been a problem for years. Now, whether it needed to be fixed or was the downtown site or the West Broadway site is something that's also there. But the great question is, what would be the benefit to the community? Any building that the school district owns should have a significant benefit to the community. And when you look at that, who benefits from a new administration building that is just there for the administration? Now, I worked for the Park Board, and the Park Board took a lot of heat many years ago when they decided to take a building on the river. But one of the smart things they did was they developed space underneath, which covered the operational costs that they had lost for years in rent downtown, just to be convenient for the city council, and they made this a sustaining building. What else will be in that building? Will it be a restaurant? What else does the North Side need? What does West Broadway need to attract people to it and to make it a welcoming environment? Another office building is not very attractive. It's not very welcoming. And certainly if they're experienced with 807, it really isn't very welcome. So I think if we're going to look at any building, we should assess what the benefit is to the community, the whole community.
Thank you.
Yeah. You know, this is a question that I somewhat tried to avoid in the campaign because I do think that what the district does not need is another issue that is polarizing and distracts from educating our kids. And this issue certainly is one. I can see all sides of the argument, honestly. I live North Minneapolis, and the economic situation on Broadway has certainly been concerning over the years. And so I hope that it brings that, and I also hope that it brings a visible kind of bench, a visible image of of the commitment that the district has. I think that the concern that I have is that if the district, as it relocates, if the academic outcomes continue to be as abysmal as they are, then I think that what it could do for the community and for the students would be kind of a failed effort. I do agree. I think that when you go into the district headquarters now, it looks about as grim as the test scores look. And so you want to be able to have people come in and know that we are proud and we care about our community and our students. And I think that what buildings look like and what we prioritize certainly sends a message. And I think that the message that building this new headquarters sent certainly was not consistent, and that more work should have been done in the front end. And I think that what the bigger issue has been around this particular topic has been transparency and who was driving the decision and how the decisions were made. And as a board member, I value transparency. I value conversations with the community. And I plan to stay very committed to engaging that way and representing what the people in the community need and want.
Thank you.
Well, I voted for that decision. And I think it was the right thing to do. It's an action that should have been taken many years ago, and it had not been because of the very issues that are being raised around it now. That building is leaking money. I mean, that we could not avoid having to invest in that space just to continue to stay there. Minimum of about $6 million would have to been put in there to do nothing, just to stay there, to make it halfway a livable space, so that if we were going to invest that kind of money, then the question was, can't we look for something that's going to have more permanency and some value? We did ask for, and I think we did get our proposal that had some community benefits to it. And the issue of transparency and community outreach, I don't know that the district has made a decision yet where that question hasn't been raised about the communications and whether or not we are being transparent in what we do. I think that over the long haul that the savings that come out of that building will give the maximum ability to reassign those resources anywhere it chooses. And it is being built with funds that are available only to capital capital building and not classroom instruction. So I think it was the proper action to take, and over the long haul, I think the community will benefit from that.
Thank you. Bonus question. Bonus time.
Okay.
Dr. Christian. The use accounts and documents that have been filed for a specific facility will cost $27.5 million, if I'm not mistaken. Earlier, one of the questions was posed, we asked the question with respect to the district's bonding assets. What is the bond rating? The question is the following. Does the district at this hour
they certainly have that amount of money in their building fund reserve, and again, as he said, that money is designated for capital improvements only, so it cannot be used in any other way. So they have the funds. They are trying to find other ways of funding, selling off buildings that have been closed and so forth and so on. However, when the statement is made that money is designated for capital expenditures, those capital expenditures did not have to be an admin building. They could have been fixing current structures, current school buildings, adding gyms that need to be added. So it wasn't specifically designated to the capital structure of an administrative building. It was for capital expenditures.
I agree. My understanding of the budget is that the money is there in the capital.
I haven't seen the master facilities plan that was promised. So, again, we're making choices, and what are the assumptions that are being applied to making those choices? There was a choice made to do this building. There was a choice to support this level of administration. Those are choices I continue to question. Is the money there? Sure, the money's there. Is the money best spent on this building? I'd say no.
Thank you.
I'm not sure the money is there. At the board meeting I attended, I think that the budget that was built was based on the sale of at least one of the available buildings. And so, you know, the district budget and budgets that go into school are complex, and so I'm not going to pretend like I understand it 100%, but I do know that the money that was received was part of one of the Obama plans and the bonding, and it was expiring, and I don't know whether or not it could have been used for other things, whether or not it was a new build or whether or not it was for repairs. But I know that I heard in that meeting that the budget was based, and there was quite a bit of discussion because they're the same buildings that have been up for sale that they haven't been able to sell. And from my understanding, that is included in the entire.
Projects like this that the funding may not always be in place at the front end. It's a question or not whether or not it is fundable. The contractor, the builder, will be a principal partner in securing the funding. This is not a building that Minneapolis Public Schools we will not build it ourselves. In a sense, we will not own it. When it is built, we'll have an opportunity at the end of a period of time to become the owners. But in order for this project to go forward, it's also dependent upon the bonding capacity of the developers. That they will be working to help secure the funding. And the multiple source funding, some of it will come from resources that the district has. And it's not solely dependent upon our having to sell property free in order to go forward with the project.
Okay, thank you very much. We have three more questions before we go into the audience questions. We have about a little bit under an hour remaining on the live broadcast. I would just like to tell the engineer at Blog Talk Radio, if you could crank up the volume some. The next question is dealing with the achievement gap. But what I have here, for three, before you ask the question, to be if elected, how would you address the achievement gap? Start here. Once you listen, just about a minute of just the announcer setting it up.
little introduction. Minister of Public Safety. Here, very interesting. But anyway, starting with if you're re-elected for case, how would you address
Well, first of all, in 2 minutes, I can't enumerate fully how I would do that, but let me just pick off three or four specifics. That I would work aggressively, implement aggressive strategies to improve student attendance and lessen student mobility. Student attendance and student mobility is the key to it, because if we don't have the students in school and in class, at least 90%+ of the time, their performance is not going to come through. They're not going to perform well. We know that that it's important to have more time on task for the students, and we need to provide the resources needed to achieve those goals. I'm more concerned about improving individual student performance than the whether or not students of color major up to white students. I want to know whether students of color are making continuous progress. We're working with them that we measure their performance today and 6 weeks out, and whatever it is that we do a formative assessment as they move along, and we do interventions with the students, because if we wait until the end of the year to test and to find out how well they're doing, those students are not going to be back with the same teacher the next year, unlikely. So whatever progress has been made, they might lose it. That I attended one class where there were 21 students in the class in September, 21 in the class in April when we were getting ready to test, but only five of those students had been there from September to April. Now, the class will be tested as 21. They will report out on the performance of 21, not of 5. And I think the teacher, if we're going to evaluate the performance of the teacher, it has to be on how well she did with those 5 students whom she had for
okay,
for
thank, you, thank you, thank you, sir.
Yeah, I think that this is a complicated thing, and there's not just one answer to it. Certainly there is a legacy and a history in the country that has had some impact on all. You know, here we have large disparities in health and in economic and in housing and in education. So there's something that's happening here that's not letting us have the conversations that we need to have around race and equity. And I think we have to begin to talk about that and look at are there some policies or practices in place that is contributing to the gap. I do think that we have to engage parents and community differently in order to have some impact on this. And then I think that you know, there is an intersection of extreme poverty, low poverty, and race. And we know that those two things together create more factors for young people. And some of the students not only have that, but they have multiple risk factors that I think that we need to identify what those risk factors are, such as, being homeless or health issues, having abusive parents, having parents that may be on drugs or whatever the case may be. And I think those are the students that we need to have some wraparound services for and prioritize, because we know that those kids that have more than 5 of those identified risk factors are the ones that are in the most trouble. And I think that if we can begin to make some movement on those students, we can move all of the students.
I'd really like to agree with Ms. Baker primarily on this. First and foremost, you have to look at this from both a micro and a macro level. And on the macro level, there's no denying that this region, and as we referenced, Minnesota, has some of the greatest racial and economic disparities, and it seems to be isolated in certain neighborhoods. So it requires a metropolitan and regional approach. So that is housing, that is tax credits, that is economic development. Those are all those things that have to be approached, and we can't do that just by neighborhood or even within the city. So there has to be not just conversations, but there needs to be action and eliminate some of the social disparities. I, you know, on a micro level, we have to look at those kids and those schools and things. And I talk an awful lot about collaboration, but let me suggest this vertical collaboration where education needs to work better together, and all the way from the teaching institutions to the unions, right down to the classroom to that teacher. But on a horizontal basis, we do have to find those social supports. The county spends an awful lot of money in terms of social services, and yet they're not very well integrated with our kids. We do have to address mobility. I talked to a young person the other day that has moved three times in one day. You know, these are realities we have to confront. We have to own. We have to find solutions for, or people won't achieve either in their test scores or in life or anything else.
Thank you.
All right. So the achievement gap. What has proven to work is applying many methods to the problem at one time, not doing piecemeal, not working on one thing and then saying, oh, but we also need to do this. We have got to reduce class size. The teachers agree, the research agrees, a large class size or actually for the teacher in a large class is not conducive to learning. Attendance is certainly a factor. Services for the students and the families. If the families are not also provided social services to assist them in having a calmer or more better learning environment at home, then the child is still not going to learn when they leave the class. The number one factor that teachers say is disruption in the classroom. So discipline is a huge factor in the district in lowering the achievement gap. But all in all, we need to engage all stakeholders. Who are the stakeholders in the achievement of our children? The parents, the community, the teachers, the board, the district, the administration. We are all stakeholders. And children that graduate from Minneapolis Public Schools stay in Minneapolis. So you better believe every single person that lives in this city is a stakeholder in our child's education.
Thank you very much. I'm going to clear the timer here. And we're going to go to question number eight. Question. And we have people that ask you questions and we'll move right into that. But move to question number eight. Give us your thinking on the plan being advanced titled Impact by the Chancellor for Washington School System. That based on performance. And the student assessment representative here in your just recently, July 23rd, DC school system fired 241 teachers. And this chancellor seems to be shaking things up out there. Her last name is Chancellor 3RE. And she seems to have a system in place that, for that school, most of the children of color out there that is doing something. So give us your thinking on that. We have 2 minutes. We're going to start on this issue with Janet. We'll start with that.
I want to apologize because I am not quite aware of Impact. I did not catch that article. That's my husband's job, actually, to give me articles that address school issues, and he did not do that. The teacher evaluation tools are always controversial. I mean, I know there is a group of teachers in California that are not pleased with what's going on and their supposed evaluation being printed in public. I know that the teachers, the standard evaluation of saying you have this one test, and the children are going to take it, and guess what? If they don't pass, you're not a good teacher. That certainly is far below what we can offer and support the teachers. Students should be regularly tested in such a way so you know their performance along the way for every unit of inquiry is that they are learning along the way. Teachers also need to be judged upon the students. Again, I agree with T, the students that are in their classroom, that they have a year long to teach, not students that enter along the way, not students that enter the last 5 weeks of school. So we need to look at all of our performance standards for teachers and make sure that they are, in fact, judging the teacher's performance and not just a random point in time.
Thank you.
Well, my wife doesn't collect the articles, and I'm familiar with Chancellor Reed's work and reputation, and I believe that this is evidence of rather dramatic surgery within the Washington, D.C. school system. And there's a belief that that was necessary. The purity of the model of and the evaluation tool is something that I'd take issue with, that you just measure based on other people's results, because there are a lot of things that affect those results. And certainly if anyone has been to Washington, D.C. and understands that community, you know that, poverty is a huge factor. So you're set up to fail. And if we continue to find ways for teachers to fail, as we have for the past 20 years, we will be very successful. I think we need to find ways for teachers to succeed. I think that we've got a number of very, very qualified, wonderful teachers, but we need to empower them to teach other teachers and to work together. I look for solutions from our teachers to this, not from administrators telling them what they can do, but that they take responsibility. There's not many teachers that I've met that have said that they're there for the paycheck, they're there for the work, and they want to be successful too. So let's find ways to do that. Should we have teacher evaluation based on test scores? Yes. Should we have teacher evaluation based on competence of students and parent involvement and welcoming environment? Yes. Should we evaluate parents? Probably yes. Should we evaluate students with something other than that? Yes. We should evaluate everybody in this thing. It's the only way we can be accountable. It's the only way we can be transparent. It's the only way we can make progress. And I think that's what this is about, not discovering failure, but discovering success.
Thank you.
Well, Chancellor Reed came out of the Teach for America program, and I think that they've approached teacher licensing and teacher placement in a much different way, an out-of-the-box way that I know has been a much-discussed topic. And so, you know, what do I think about it? I think that it's probably properly titled in terms of impact, because we're talking about it here. And firing everyone made a statement across the country, for sure, of her commitment and seriousness and her courage to be able to say, I'm going to shake some things up, and what's been happening can't be tolerated because kids are failing. You know, is it extreme? Yes. Will it work? We don't know yet. I do think that there is a growing movement, and I've seen lots of articles related to communities of color that are pushing back on the tenure and seniority structure, mostly because of the impact it has on recruitment of teachers of color, and because folks are saying, you know, we do want better for our kids and for our communities, and you know, you can't have reform on one side. The schools can't reform without the union side reforming. Now, having said that, my husband is a steward in the union for the last 18 years, so I understand seniority and tenure, and I understand the benefits of it. So I do think that there needs to be evaluation, and I think and feel strongly that we have to see results. Because it says performance and test scores, I have not read the complete plan, although I have read quite a bit of Chancellor Reed's work. I believe that it's a multi-measured approach, and test scores is one indicator, but there are also some other indicators that are written into that plan.
Thank you.
I believe that we should have a way of assessing teacher performance. Should test scores be a part of that? Test should be among the performance indicators, but should not be the sole performance indicator. There are too many uncontrollable variables involved in order to show test scores as the lead indicator. The point that I made earlier on of the 21 students in the class with only five being there at the end of the school year when they were tested is one indication of that. And that we would, I think it is, what we're doing in Minneapolis, that we have already engaged a consultant to work with the district and with the teachers to develop a teacher's performance tool. And that's going to be done in consultation with the teachers and in Minneapolis, and I don't know about other districts. That is something that will have to be negotiated.
And so it's one thing to talk about having it. We can all agree that it can be an important tool. Then we have to think about what's the best approach of introducing it. And it certainly is something that has to be done in collaboration with the teachers. And it can't be a one performance indicator that is used. It has to, there have to be multiple performance indicators, and we have to be very clear about the kinds of outcomes that we're looking for, and the outcomes have to be measurable.
Thank you. Bonus time. This was initiated by one minute, starting. And you indicate a model currently in effect in the United States of America that would accomplish your expectation based on what you just said.
I can't identify a specific a model that is currently doing that because I'm not intimately familiar with them, but I know that there are variations of this model, particularly around the teachers one in Montgomery County, Maryland. And it was something that was designed and developed in a collaborative effort between the teachers' union and the school board, the school administrators, so that they were clear about what kinds of outcomes they were looking for. That the union had a clear idea of what those outcomes should look like for them. And the district, the board, and the administrators had a clear idea as to what those outcomes should look like, and they came together to negotiate those and gain agreement around the outcomes and how to measure those outcomes.
Thank you, sir. Ms. McBain.
Yeah, the one example I can think of is Winthrop University High School in Cincinnati. Principal Sharon Johnson there. It's a district school. It was not doing well at all. The proficiency rates were in the 20%, 17% in science. And within 4 years, they went up to 90% in reading and math and about low 80% for science proficiency rates. And part of what she did was institute performance outcomes for everyone in the building, not just the teachers, and said that everybody in this building is responsible for academic achievement, and that every role and everything that we do has to be directed towards that end, and if it does not, and if it's not making movement, then it doesn't need to be here. So significant impact, and they've actually eliminated the graduation rate, white and black, in that school.
On a large system level, I'd agree with Mr. Williams, and I'm familiar with Montgomery County's research and some of the promising results. The on a narrower basis, the Chicago, some of the work John Simmons has done with teachers in individual schools that have developed models, and I can't think of the schools specifically, but they did pull teachers, parents, and others together to develop models and showed, again, results. On a personal level, when we started Katahdin working with delinquent kids in a relatively very small group, we saw gains of 2 to 3 grade levels in 6 months. And that model measured a whole lot of things other than just math and reading. It also measured confidence and helped the family and family results. So I think there are ways that this can be done. But again, you have to start with kids that you have.
Thank you.
All right, so I am familiar with the John Simmons model. I actually quote it in some of my literature and agree that bringing the stakeholders together to agree upon an outcome that has to be achieved, there's some, there's a lot of buy-in, and there's also some bonus structure to that for achieving certain goals. I think that is a good outcome, but everyone has to buy in, and everyone has to know what the goal of the district is. They have to know what the goal of the school is. That has to be well communicated and continual reminder that everyone is working towards the same goal, and I don't know that that's always the case. I really love the U.S. News and World Report the article they do about the schools. They have a lot of factors that they judge schools across the country, but it is about 14 to 25 factors, and that is something that we could look at for teachers because there's so many things that go in to teaching children in the classroom, not just tests.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. You did such a great job answering the impact question that we're not going to beat a dead horse and ask what would be your position. You did a good job. So we just stuck the bonus question in there. But we will move to question 10, and this is the last question. Thank you. Radio show, and again, I got to pay the bills. We're broadcasting on the Blog Talk Radio. Ron Edwards and Don Allen on point on Saturday, 4 p.m. Every Saturday. Okay, and we'll go back. And then we'll go. This is take 15 seconds.
15 seconds.
It's a simple question. Please.
Yes or no?
Okay,
okay. All right.
Okay.
Awesome.
15 seconds. If you were not running for the school board seat, which one of the candidates would you vote for and why?
Which one of the candidates would you vote for and why? And I'm assuming it's someone sitting at the table, not
yes,
a write-in.
Yes,
okay, super. Okay, I would actually vote for Richard Maimon, who is able, I think he has enough, influence is not the right word. He's been in the community long enough where he can pull a lot of people together, a lot of communities together, a lot of city, park, and at this point in time, when we all think community is very important, stakeholders are important, we need people that are on the board that have a relationship.
Thank you.
Man, 15 seconds up yet. Now, I'm still undecided, and that has to do with behavior that you learn on the campaign trail and the ethics and the value. I very, very much appreciate and respect all three of these people. I really do. That's very sincere. But as we get into the tough things and the rough and tumble of politics, I've learned more in the last 8 months about behavior and the people around them. These people are great. The people that are around them, we need to work with
them. Sorry.
It's an imposing question, but I will answer it. I would have to say T, and because I do think that Northside representation is important. And if I wasn't running, and I think that with the amount of folks of color we have, students of color in the district, it's extremely important to have representation. And so that's why.
This is indeed is an imposing question, and I probably should be a smart enough politician not to answer it. Miss Baker is my neighbor across the street. And I like the things that she talks about. And I tell you, let me just stop right there.
Okay, that's fine. That's great. Now, before we get to the questions, audience questions, we need to give a special thanks to Rock for letting us have this here. Lisa Bryant, journalist, with really great press release. Pam Colby, this is the PPP broadcast on the television network and the cameraman. What's your name anyway? That's Eric. Yeah, let's give Eric a hand for Minneapolis Television Network. I'm listening to Ashley Audio Guy, who's going to hop in.
Audio Bill was a great AV guy. This was supposed to be a recorder. IBN News, Apple, Blog Talk Radio, again, U-Rock, National Super. That we work hand in hand on actually forming these questions so we can get our variety of answers rather than just one of the questions I had in my head. And News Network, PR Law, and
the Twin Cities are in the state of Minnesota have 98% weekly coverage of radio, print, and television. And they have 4% coverage. Right. Now, we have Mr. Lewis King, who's an educator, and we have Ms. Faye Harper, who's an educator, and Mr. King, we'd like to pose the question first. And I got some basic for top
five.
One for you there. For you, and I think this is the same thing, and then I'll go.
Oh, okay.
I'll go backwards.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah, I'm multitasking today.
Doing a good job.
Gagnon. That's me, Daniel. Canadian French. Absolutely, thank you.
Yeah. Right here. I live in Woodbury.
Oh. That's okay. The first question, would I would I recommend people send their kids to these schools? I would, yes, because I know people, a lot of people in these school communities, and there are a number of communities that have bound together. Lyndale is one of them. Whittier has improved significantly. The community came in force, bound together, and their test scores have improved greatly. And I believe that's possible for these schools also, if you have a supportive community, and we keep working towards that goal. I did not quite catch the entirety of the second question.
Would you, as a school board member, and one of the two of you will be elected,
yes, sir,
support working with people who have demonstrated the effectiveness of programs to get results with the population that have high mobility, high poverty, and our children are the kids who graduate from here?
Yes.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Anna, please.
Absolutely. I would certainly advocate that parents need to do what's best for their child and where they live and how this community functions. Each of these schools have different personalities, what fits better. Would I recommend Harvest Prep? Absolutely, and have in many cases. I've known Eric and F. Mahmoud for years, as you know, Lewis. I've got great respect for the discipline, the rigor, the humanity of that building. Whether they're a charter school or a Minneapolis public school, they're an effective school that engages community in other ways. I think those things, those lessons, need to be applied in all of these schools. And that happens because people are really involved, because people make that happen. And there is an openness to making that happen. It's not sent from 807. It's done right there in the building. So what I recommend is, yes, if they feel comfortable and they're going to be included in the process of shaping their kids' education. If they don't
thank
feel
you,
welcome,
thank you very much for the answer.
Yes, yes. Okay.
Mr. King touched on a lot of issues. One, there's a lot of families that are already walking with their feet, which has been a big topic of discussion in some of the conversation around the district budget has been mostly around that. My experience with charter schools at Pillsbury United Communities has gone back about 3 years, and in that time we've also looked and partnered, and as a Hope Collaborative we've brought things to the district, and it has been very difficult. And I think part of what you're asking is do we have the courage to make difficult decisions and partner differently, and the answer is yes. And I think that even me running for this seat, having had charter school experience and having a couple of children in charter schools, I think that that's the beginning of the discussion, is that it's too divided. And I happen to be someone in this community that people ask where to send their kids all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's a difficult question to answer because parents are often looking for different things. And so what I have, the approach that I've taken is one of sending them to the state website and says that part of your responsibility is to go in and look at the state school.
Thank you very much. Please.
The answer to your question is yes, and I have done so. And when I have referred parents to particular schools, I've told them what to expect, and I've asked them to let me know what the outcome is. And if you experience something that you believe you did to not have experienced, let me know about it, and I'm going to be prepared to follow up. Well, we are right now looking at schools who outside of the district who have demonstrated that they can work well and have good results with the students that we are talking about here. And we have, as you may know, Mr. King, we have authorized two new schools that has demonstrated that they have the capacity to work well with the population that we are talking about, and have produced good results. It's one thing that you can do it, but it requires continuous engagement in that process. And I always tell parents when I say go to school, be prepared to stay engaged. And I am unequivocally supportive of public schools.
Thank you very much. Ms. Purple, you have 1 minute to ask a question. 1 minute, excuse me. You have 1 minute to ask a question, and then they'll answer. We have less than 40 minutes left on the broadcast. Thank you.
You can go now.
This is to the potential school board members. Have you considered
down to the accountability and the people doing their job, so they know what the job is.
We have a lot of people in administration, have a lot of authority, but no power. It's one of the most baffling organizations I've ever seen. So I think that unless, and I do count on Superintendent Johnson to correct that, and new leadership to correct that. I think the plan that the board has put in place, you know, can allow that to happen. I think changing school options can make some things happen. This thing has been upset. Other ways, we've got to look at it fresh, and people have to understand what their value is to the system in achieving the educational gains of students. That is the purpose of the organization. It's not sustaining bureaucrats. Lastly, I want to agree with Sean's point about the learning gap. This has a lot to do with culture and leadership in the building. This has a lot to do with the relationships between the teachers and administration and parents and all those things, and we need to look at where we are successful, where we are fair, where we are just, and where we create hope. And that's what we need to have, along with citywide math programs and reading programs. We need to have just civility curriculum.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. The district just currently actually went through an employee audit. Just to come out with some basic facts, are they being paid nationwide? A lot of that, you know, it would be a very good idea to also go through a performance audit, but currently there's not a lot of accountability in place and ways to measure that. And I know that it's being worked upon. It's been done for Bernadilla, but it needs to be done throughout the system, because how can you make that decision if you can't, if you don't know who the people are that are at the bottom 20%. So certainly putting accountability and measurements of that into place very soon and using those would fresh start 807 quite well. Just schools across the district don't have equitable programs, so that needs to be fixed.
Thank you. Thank you. We're down to like 7 minutes. And I want you to have a closing statement. But is there anybody with a question that Mr. Chisholm? We're going to have, like, just a brief answer for this, and then I want you guys to, like, use the last 6 minutes for closing statement and for the phase out.
Thanks for taking time. My name is Lenny Chisholm. One of the things I found to be quite interesting is that even if we graduate 4.0 students, system, out of North High, the retention rate of those students in the community will be continually low. This is the fact that it's affecting our community growth. We have very few second and third generation kids attending Gold High. As a member of the school board, that's a short term in order to improve the community. How will you have an issue to keep these kids in the community after they've graduated, maybe went on to college, and want to come back to build as they do it in time, like very often, and so on?
Thank you, sir. Virtually impossible. At 30 seconds, we'll start with Baker, our way down.
I am a second generation North High grad. North High is very important to me and to this community. The issue of retention in the community has to be a partnership with the business groups, and even they're having a hard time keeping folks of color that they're recruiting from out of the country. So, I mean, from out of the state. So I think it's a challenge that we have to look at all the way around. And I think that schools honestly have to have more of a focus on in community engagement and volunteerism and the value of community, and reinforce that with projects and other things.
Madam, please, 30 seconds.
North High and the implicit threat to close it is one of the things that I'm most scared about, and I would never vote to close North High. I think it's an important institution. If we lose this, we've lost a lot, a big piece of ourselves, our history, and I think our future. So that said, what Chanda said is absolutely correct. There has to be a conspiracy within the community to keep people here, which means they have to be valued, number one, which means you have to have housing patterns, you have to have jobs, you have to have after-school programs, you have to have caring people like Lorraine Smaller and other people who are going to be involved in your life that you value and that you know they value you.
All right, thank you. If we're busing children all over, they're not forming a community. They're not building a community. They're not engaged in their community. And if you have the children attending North, if they don't have the neighbor children also attending North, then they're not fully forming a community that will function in the future. So we need to get back on track so that North High is a community school. It serves that community and it draws that community, because therefore, you know, you, if you're not a, if you're not feeling a part of the community or disenfranchised, then you're not going to come back.
Increased opportunities. If there are no opportunities in the community that will attract and keep people there, then they're going to go where the opportunities are. And we need a strong community economic development strategy that builds community and provide opportunities in the community for those people who have talent and can attract them back to it. Without that, that isn't something that we can do as a school board member. The district can't do that. That's a community issue, a community problem, and has to be solved by the greater community itself. And the school become a partner in that process.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have less than 3 minutes in the show, and I know we have some hands up for some questions. I apologize. Like I said, we're just going to keep this as long as the radio program, 2 hours. We also can broadcast to the Apple Health Network. So in closing statements, we're going to start down here with Steve Williams. We're going to start right to my right. 45 seconds. And the next couple of minutes here, everyone to closing statements.
I'm T. Williams. I'm running for re-election to the school board. And I think that one of the things I want to follow that financially our biggest challenge is the erosion of our foundation funding. The only increase that we've received in a decade for services above and beyond and come with strings attached. We have, out of a $650 million budget, we have $250 million of that that's on soft money. We have core programs that are operating on soft money. Unless we can find some way to replace those programs with and connect them to the general fund, then we're going to continue to be in this situation.
Mm-hmm. I'm Shonda Smith-Baker. I'm also running as an at-large candidate. I'm a Northside resident, and I have been committed to education and the district and strongly state public education for the last 17 years. I think because of my experience in charter schools and because of my experience living on the north side and understanding the challenges that we're currently facing and the fact that I have kids in all of these grade levels, I think I bring a unique voice. The decisions I would make on the board would have impact on my household. I have the courage to make the tough decisions. I made a tough decision to decide to run. I have the work ethic, and I have the passion, and I have the desire to see outcomes for kids change, and particularly the kids that I'm seeing on the
street.
Thank
you very much.
I'm Richard Mammon. I'm an at-large candidate for the school board, and I also am here because I believe I can make a difference, and the way I can make a difference is by empowering other people in this community to be part of this. Minneapolis had a great school system for many years. It hasn't for many more, but it's still salvageable. It's still important. Public education is the best means, the best investment we have in social justice. If we abandon that, if we give up on that, if we just fragment that, we'll have lost a lot more. So if we can come together, and I want to work with these folks and everyone in this community to make this a strong school system, a strong community, and a place where all kids feel valued.
Thank you.
Rebecca Gagnon, at-large school board candidate. I'm a district-wide volunteer. I have a district-wide perspective. I have been involved at many levels with different groups, the special ed, Title I. I have 3 kids at all 3 levels of schools, high school, middle school, and elementary. I have kids at a magnet school and a community school. I see what works, and I also see a community all over the city that is passionate about their public schools and wants a school in their community, and I want to fight for that.
Okay. Give yourself a hand, please. Everyone. We're still available for podcast, for the Minneapolis story, it's also being broadcast on Minneapolis Health Network. If you want to find that, please tell me about Minneapolis Health Network. This was Black Focus. radio box. Questions and these networks, the Harbaugh and Beauty Outlaw. I'm Don Allen, and Blog Talk Radio on point.
Yeah.
We're done.